In this special episode of the IDS Between the Lines podcast, Andy Sumner, Professor of International Development at King's College London and President of the European Association of Development Research and Training Institutes, interviews Professor Melissa Leach, who leaves IDS after 33 years, which includes the last decade of her being the director of IDS. As a social anthropologist and geographer, Melissa's interdisciplinary policy-engaged research in Africa and beyond links environment, agriculture, health, technology, and gender, with a particular interest in knowledge, power, and the politics of science and policy processes. In the conversation, Melissa talks about what her main research and policy contributions have been and how have these evolved over the years, how has development studies changed over her time at IDS, and what does she see as the main opportunities and challenges for the future in an uncertain world?
Today, I'm going to be interviewing Melissa Leach. Let me hand over to Melissa to introduce herself.
Hello. Well, Andy, thank you for this opportunity. So I'm Melissa. I've been director of IDS and the privilege to lead this extraordinary and wonderful institution for the last decade. But my time at the Institute actually goes back a lot further. I joined in 1990, fresh out of a PhD in social anthropology with a background in geography. So in terms of thinking about my time here and my contributions, one can talk about more than a third of a century or a decade.
Thank you. Why don't we start with thinking a little bit about, I mean, in your time at IDS, feel free to go back as far as you wish. How do you see as your kind of your main research and policy contributions?
Well, at the time I joined the Institute in 1990, I came to help develop work on environment, and this was, of course, the moment of the Rio 1992 conference, and the world was just waking up to the significance of climate change, of biodiversity loss, of pollution, and of environmental challenges. And that was my initial role at the Institute. And indeed, environment and sustainability themes were a big part of my own research contribution, really through subsequent decades up until now. And that went through a lot of research in West Africa around forests and then soils, and then programs that I led with colleagues in IDS and externally around developing frameworks for understanding interactions between livelihoods in the environment, environmental entitlements. And then we built with the Science Policy Research Unit, the STEPS Centre, a big ESRC centre, which I led between 2006 and actually 2014, when I finally stepped down from a formal role to become director. But the legacy of the STEPS Centre and the pathways approach that we built collaboratively for understanding innovation, sustainability, development challenges, and really understanding how change is always valued differently by different groups and underpinned by diverse narratives and storylines and power, and taking that into different domains from food and agriculture, energy and climate, water and sanitation, and indeed health and disease, has remained a very big part of my subsequent contributions, where I've gone on working with those colleagues around areas like green transformations, the financialization of nature, and so on. But I think the other research area that I've had the privilege of pursuing while at IDS has been in global health, working with colleagues around health systems and particularly around pandemics. We led, in the context of the West African Ebola outbreak in 2013, an Ebola response anthropology platform, which won several impact awards and really set the bar for how and why one can bring social science knowledge into responses to health emergencies and, by implication, emergencies of many other kinds. And of course, these days they cross-cut and involve climate and conflict very often too. And really pioneering a kind of platform model for bringing the right kind of knowledge and evidence into the hands of responders at the right time. So I suppose environment, health, have been projects that have cross-cut both of those. And cross-cutting them again has been my abiding interest, not just in tackling poverty, but also thinking about inequities, injustices, and how we can work to address those, both in particular sectors, but in development more generally. And so about halfway through my directorship period, I had the privilege to be academic lead with the Institute of the World Social Science Report on Challenging Inequalities, and also worked for UN Women around gender inequalities and pathways to sustainability. So this whole theme of inequity and equity has carried on. And most recently, I've been taking those ideas into the area of food, helping to support the Food Equity Centre that IDS has established, and linking up also with international partners in the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems.
And you haven't mentioned your long-standing study and interest in West Africa. I mean, that's something that really goes back, I think, I guess, to your PhD. I wonder if you tell us a little bit about that, because in a way, we have all these kind of, there's these big questions around inequality, health, sustainability.
Yeah.
And also, you've actually worked a lot at the ground level, trying to understand different ways of seeing problems and solutions.
Absolutely. So I think the project, the study that really defined my own career and interests and the way I've come to look at things with others was actually not my PhD. I mean, I did a PhD in forest areas in Sierra Leone, which had a big focus on gender, an area I've gone on working with people in since. But it was actually a study in the Republic of Guinea. It's a different part of that West African forest zone. Which with my partner and husband, James Fairhead, we spent years through the 1990s working with colleagues on the ground, and particularly Dominique Milamuno, who was a historian and philosopher from the region, who was our core research partner, and living in villages in that area. And it was a kind of mind-changing study, because we went to study the social dynamics of deforestation in an area where all donors and scientific observers, right back to the French colonial period, believed forests to be in terminal decline, disappearing fast, with only small relics of forests left around villages as the kind of last bits left of the destructive practices wrought by farmers, mainly in the region, through their agriculture and their fire setting. And what that research revealed through oral histories, through just getting on with everyday life with villagers, and then adding to that work in archives and work with aerial and satellite pictures, was a totally reverse story. This was a landscape that was filling and half filling with forests fast. Islands were the outposts of new forests, not the relics of declining forest. And forests were there because of people, not despite them. So that's the story in a nutshell that became the basis of the book we published called Misreading the African Landscape, the film Second Nature, which I've actually gone on discussing with students as well as with others elsewhere, right up to the present, and indeed further publication projects in the wider West African region, but also launched a big interest for me in what is it about science and power that lead so many so often to overlook the lived experiences, the everyday knowledges and forms of expertise that are there in people's lives. And it's interesting, because although that work was quite a while ago, the issues it raised have remained and keep resurfacing. So that area is now being targeted for reforestation efforts now, not about biodiversity or watershed protection, but in the context of climate change, and that's where the concern is. Those histories that villages brought to us are now all too easily forgotten. And so those involved in conservation in the region are surprised anew when confronted with the histories and to discover that actually these forests haven't always been there. There are new stories emerging around the soils that underlie these forest patches, which we pursued in another project, finding anthropogenic dark earths at the root of all of these. And there's the basis for a whole set of theorizing about how it is that disease happens. So it was these same forest patches that were seen as the source of patient zero and the transmission of bat viruses to people at the start of Ebola, overlooking the fact that people in this region had lived for a long time with bats and actually had other explanations for why a virus should spread in that place at that time. So it's gone on being an interesting place that I've visited and continued to think about with people. But it's also been an area and a set of lenses really to challenge the power relations, which often drive the knowledge, the narratives, the storylines that condition the way development issues and problems are framed and the way solutions are found, who we listen to, whose voices count. Yeah. And why?
That seems to, I mean, looking on your career, across your career, that's that really interesting point about knowledge and power and the kind of framing of perspectives and the sort of the marginalization of ground level or people's day-to-day knowledge. When you take that kind of knowledge that you've generated with people and then you try and take that to power, you know, take it to people who can do something about it, or at least do something more substantial about it. How have you found that? Because you're taking what's considered, I mean, scientific knowledge is quite often defined in a certain way, and what you're doing is almost turning it on its head and saying, actually, you should be listening to these people, not sort of reading, I don't know, this journal or this paper from the World Bank or something like that.
To some extent, yes. And I mean, I should say at this point that the kind of traditions of working with local knowledge and everyday lived experience and the kinds of participatory methods that are helpful in doing that are, of course, a long-standing tradition and stock in trade of work at IDS. So I've been able to interact and support and admire just vast amounts of practice and projects in intervening periods in the Institute that have covered no end of issues. So some on environment, others looking at children's work or exclusion from governance processes, or how minoritized groups come to have voice, or indeed in some of the work I've done with my health colleagues, how we understand people's anxieties about vaccination or about public health interventions. So it's a very, very rich scene. What I've tried to do, and what some of the IDS work does, is not just look from the margins and the bottom up, because that does give you a different view and a very important angle on debates from which many, many bigger lessons can be learned, but also to take those lenses which question power, culture, knowledge to the powerful themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that was a part of my work in West Africa all those years ago, where we actually tried to interrogate not just the culture, knowledge, power within those communities, those Kisi and Karanko villages, but also what it was in the government forest department or in the World Bank and EU projects that were trying to intervene in those areas, to ask how it was that dominant regimes of science had linked up with institutional power, with political economy, with certain kinds of funding incentives to make a certain way of looking at, in this case, the environment, so normal, as it were. Mm-hmm. You can call this discourse. I've done it. I mean, this is kind of the discourses of development. And mm-hmm. it's the lens that in my own work and with others at IDS, we've then taken to many, many other areas, exploring through social science approaches, through participation, mm-hmm. through ethnography, through power analysis, how it is that governments, that donors, that international agencies come to frame problems, tell particular stories about them, construct certain narratives about the nature of the world, which give you a certain angle on a problem and drive certain kinds of solutions, but often miss out on a whole lot else. And most recently, I suppose, in the work our health group did, has been doing around epidemics and pandemics, including in the COVID context. We've done the same again to kind of try and juxtapose the global and regional discourses about pandemic preparedness and response, particularly as applied to African settings, which often are about certain kinds of technical response, certain global priorities, certain ideas about where the solutions will lie, often in pharmaceuticals and drugs and vaccines, and certain kinds of ideas about involving communities, usually to slightly instrumentalize them into biomedical ways of thinking. But at the same time, where does that sit with the more localized concepts and practices that emerge from settings where people are living with the effects, not just of disease, but also of the responses to disease, the attempts at public health control, which are coming from these more top-down models. So looking at these convergences and divergences and areas of contestation of different kind of conjunctures of power and knowledge has been something that's always really, really interested me.
I remember when I was at IDS, Hilary Standing once said to me what she was trying to do was make the discourse quiver, in a sense, yeah, of showing that there are multiple ways of seeing things. And, you know, just the one framing that exists at one point in time can easily be challenged. I can obviously see that across your work. And also you have a lot of interaction between spatial science and physical science, that kind of interface between very different ways of seeing the world and very, very different ways of seeing human beings as the subject of research as well. I mean, how have you found that mixing with physical scientists and especially coming from an anthropology background? It's one thing that perhaps coming from a sort of economist background and trying to mix with being a physical scientist, maybe it's a different experience, but how have you found it coming from your background? Yeah.
Well, it's something that I've always done. And again, it's a kind of way of working and of thinking about interdisciplinarity that I feel I've helped to foster within IDS more broadly, where most of us in the Institute are of social science backgrounds of various kinds, be it anthropology like myself, or economics or political science or sociology or participatory approaches. And in my own work, I've always found interacting with those who bring different sort of often slightly more technical specialisms incredibly important for getting a grip on a problem. So my research has engaged with botanists, with ecologists, with soil scientists, in the health work, with biomedical scientists, with health planners, often with vets. One of the most interesting and challenging projects I helped to lead with others when I was working in the STEP Centre was called Dynamic Drivers of Disease in Africa. And we worked with partners who were vets, biomedics, ecologists, environmental modellers, and tried to unite all of these around a similar framework. And in the end concluded that this was not possible. And actually what you couldn't do, I mean, they would all bring different perspectives to a problem and a set of questions. And here we were interested in how it was that disease is transmitted from animals to people in diverse ecologies and livelihood settings in five different African places. And we couldn't ever find a kind of lowest common denominator, single framing. But what we did do was triangulate. And this is the way I've come to see interdisciplinarity. It's not about getting everybody to think the same. It's not about integrating perspectives. It's often about triangulating. So you retain the value of the particular angle that discipline gives you, or that its particular way of modeling or seeing the world gives you. And then bring it together with others. And that's the way we can build a richer picture. It does involve, to work well, it involves often being together, whether it's together in discussion or together in a field setting, where people can really debate things as they see them and interact with them. And it's all too easy then for the researchers to go back into their own silos. And it also takes time, and it takes trust, and it takes relationship building, because across different disciplines we often bring very, very different assumptions, we speak very different languages, And it takes a while to build even the basis of working well together. But it's something that can be incredibly valuable if you get it right.
I'm thinking about the sort of the big challenges that you've worked on, issues around sustainability. These are inevitably cross-disciplinary questions, thinking about the future. And just sort of broadening out slightly in terms of thinking, how do you see questions around sustainability evolving? Clearly, climate change is only likely to become more evident. Yeah. But, you know, the prospects of some kind of constraint on emissions look limited at best, even for an optimist. And so we're heading into, you know, a world over the next 10 or 20 years, which is going to be really rather more turbulent in terms of agriculture patterns, migration. But what are the questions ahead, and what are the ways to think about this?
Yeah. Well, I think the questions ahead are in part about the ways that any given aspect of the planetary crisis that we're facing interacts with others. So there's climate change, but at the same time, we're dealing with biodiversity loss, with pollution, with a range of other ways in which the planetary futures that we're all dependent on are interacting with each other. And the second is that to address those, I think we need approaches that are both systems based and are actually transformative. And in the STEP Centre in our last years, we began to think seriously about transformation and its politics, and produced one book publication, which was called The Politics of Green Transformations, and argued that this required really quite fundamentally different ways of doing things, and that some of those transformations needed to come from the bottom up. They were about listening to what citizens and social movements were often doing in terms of leading the way in different ways of living with non-human natures and enabling them to thrive. Great deal we can learn there from marginalized people, pastoralists, indigenous groups, and so on, but also from the everyday lives of citizens, which are often embroiled in much more sustainable practices and forms of connectivity with nature than people realize, because we're often told by our dominant sciences that we're all separated, and actually we're often much more connected than we realize, and there are abilities to build on that in the transformations we need. But at the same time, the causes and consequences and impacts of these big changes are global, and they are deeply structural. And they are part of geopolitics, of structural inequalities, which go back a long way, which have created the kind of big gaps between the countries responsible for carbon emissions and those expected to respond to them. We've got new forms of action aimed at mitigation, which often end up creating new inequities and injustices. So the work that often is happening now in the interests of market-based approaches, carbon offsets, the revaluation of nature to meet global emissions reduction targets and net zero, which can often in their wake produce new kinds of dispossession, things that some of us analyzed as green grabs a number of years ago and which are still very live. So we need, I think, to think about some quite radical changes, but ones that are coupling up justice in of a number of different kinds with the changes to the ways people are living and the ways policies are going. And that's justice that's partly distributional. We need to be asking who's gaining and who's losing. It's partly procedural about who's at the table, who's making these decisions about mitigation and adaptation and their financing and nature-based solutions and where they should happen and who designs them. It's partly recognitional in terms of whose rights and claims and positions and knowledges are recognized. And it's partly what people are now talking about as restorative justice, where we realize that the predicaments that we're all in around environment, planetary futures, climate, biodiversity are also the product of long-term inequalities and changes. And addressing presents and futures is often going to require restoring and acting on some of those past inequities too. So there's a lot of discussion at the moment about just transitions. Some of the work at IDS and work I've been doing with colleagues elsewhere would be arguing for just transformations as well, looking into the future.
But by just transformations, you mean redistributive justice in different scales and levels?
I mean that we're talking not just about tweaks to the status quo. I mean, transitions in many debates are mostly about incremental change. They might be about shifting the incentives for business or for governments. They might be about small changes to the technologies or the way finance is distributed. That's a little bit different from acknowledging a more transformative approach, which means laying bare and challenging the broader power relations and power knowledge relations, which are underpinning the status quo, and beginning to find ways to challenge those from the bottom up and from the top down. And so when I say those so the changes we're looking at need to be transformative, but they also need to be just in terms of producing justice for people and indeed for non-human natures. I think there's some really important work going on around multi-species justice actually at the moment. But that justice is of many different kinds. It's distributive, it's procedural, it's recognitional, and it's also restorative.
You are listening to an episode of the IDS Between the Lines podcast. For the full set of episodes, please visit www.ids.ac.uk/podcast.
I just wonder whether are you still an optimist, and how do you, if you are still an optimist, how do you manage to remain an optimist?
I think there are both grounds for despair and grounds for hope in where we are at the moment, honestly. And I mean, if we look at a world of geopolitical tensions of a kind that we've certainly not seen in my career space, taking new forms. If we look at the extent to which multiple kinds of crisis are intersecting with each other, if we look at the sheer number of countries who are, as it were, falling out of what we had imagined was democratic progress, and we've got a sheer extent of war and of conflict in place after place. So these are all grounds for despair, but pessimism, but also grounds for continuing to struggle, actually. And one of the activities I've been engaged in of late is contributing to the latest Human Development Report, the UNDP HDR. And this year's report, just released in a couple of weeks ago, is called Breaking the Gridlock. And it's trying to make some arguments about how the world could begin to move forward collectively on some of these challenges. And the answers it finds lie in a reconceptualization of global public goods as things that really matter. And some re-looking at institutions which refresh the multilateralism that we've had, which is at the moment really badly stymied by geopolitics, frankly, to be more imaginative about the institutional makeup and the connections between global and local. So this brings me to my grounds for hope, which at the moment I see mostly emerging out of movements, out of social movement struggles, out of activist struggles, out of youth activism, and out of the kind of politics and democratic politics which are not happening through the ballot box, but are happening through people claiming space, through sometimes more informal, popular kinds of movements, which are making claims to do things differently. And we see this across food, across health, across environment, across energy. And if the hope that I see is actually in ways that these movements might begin to coalesce and start to place some real pressure on decision makers from below, in a way to return to the sort of pathways analogy that colleagues and I worked with in the STEP Centre and that I found a useful metaphor to think with. Can we imagine pathways from below beginning to join up? So the footpaths become the small roadways, and the roadways then begin to become the highways, and gradually those highways start to make inroads and maybe over time help to displace the big motorways that are currently dominating our world. And if we look back, I think historically, some of the really big transformations in our history, that's often the way that really big change happened, whether you're talking about the rise of the vote for women or the ending of slavery, or indeed what we're seeing in energy system transformations, where many, many energy revolutions in cities and countrysides across the world are beginning to add up to something very different around low carbon energy transformations. So these are my grounds for hope, but I call it a politics of hope, because ultimately where all of this depends on power and on politics with a small p as well as a big P. And if we need to do anything moving forward, it's to recenter even further power and challenges to power in all its guises in the development discourse. And I'm now thinking about transformative futures.
Actually, that brings us nicely to something I wanted to raise next, which is development studies itself. I mean, you've been director of one of the best known globally institutes of development studies, and obviously long history there, even prior to the directorship. I mean, how do you see development studies responding, how do you think development studies evolves in your time? I mean, either during your decade as director or prior to that even, and you know, how does development studies kind of step up to these enormous challenges and not give up? I mean, that seems to be the core thing, right? Yeah. Keep struggling.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's changed in many ways. One is a broadening out of disciplines. So the development studies that I joined when I began at IDS in 1990 was centrally dominated by economics and by development economics, which is hugely important, but has now been, I think, enriched and added to by a much wider range of engagements from anthropology, sociology, political science, participation, and so on. And I think more recently, and one of the really big opportunities going forward, is to decenter some of that academic work and its theorizing even further, to take on board the theorizing that's emerging from the Global South, from indigenous philosophies, from everyday lived experiences, and so on. So that's just coming and is a hugely important way forward. I think development studies has also changed enormously in terms of the issues it focuses on. So back in the 1990s, I've already said that when I joined, it was partly in the context of environment becoming a more central focus. But we were also at that point just seeing the kind of fruition of really important interest in gender, the rise of concerns with governance as key parts of development agendas, and the enriching of what had been quite really a major focus on development as being about modernity and about industrial development paths, and how countries were able to move from export dependence to import substitution and so on, and a quite sort of national level focus on what development was about. This was really about countries moving on from their particular colonial experiences to become modern, however that's defined. And what I've seen and welcomed and hope I've been part of over the last period is a big set of changes which envisage development and by implication development studies as far, far more than the discourses and practices of a development industry born out of that post-Truman Second World War moment of countries acquiring independence and then being supported by these new institutions coming out of Bretton Woods and setting in place a kind of aid agenda. And I think where we already were very clearly 10 years ago when I joined was as director was a rethink of development and development studies as progressive change more generally. We were talking at that point a decade ago about beyond aid, about things like South-South cooperation, about the emergent and very different ways of thinking about and practicing development that were coming from other countries. We were challenging those divisions between developed and developing in a big way. And we were opening up, as I think IDS had done for a long time, towards the very different versions of progressive change that were coming from different places and different parts of the world and different groups of people. So the participatory work and the ongoing work of people like Robert Chambers, who had always defined development as good change generally, fitted very well with where I think many of us have tried to take development since, to say it's good change, but then we need to open up a debate about who's good and what kind of change we want and who's defining it. So then we're in a world where development is actually something that's quite plural. And is open to different pathways and then needs to be deliberated over, recognizing that there are going to be radically different versions and there's no single route to progress anywhere. And we need to be much more pluralistic in terms of how we define where development should be going. So I think that's a big overarching change which has characterized my time over the last 10 years anyway.
And you've written recently, over the last few years, particularly about this kind of question of universality of development and whether development studies should extend to a given blurring of binaries between the North and the South. Should development studies extend to, I mean, Dudley Sears always talked about development studies coming home to Europe, and Dudley wrote, as you know, I'm sure, the book, where he tried to apply dependency theory to Europe at one point, which was really interesting. And I think his last three books, in fact, I think were on Europe and questions around politics. So I think there's clearly a discussion here about kind of where does development really sit vis-a-vis social change, social progress in the North. Mm. Can you say a little bit about how you see this or how you think it can or should evolve?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, you're quite right, of course, Andy. This does go back to the very beginning of development studies. And if you take IDS as one of the earliest kind of think tanks, research institutions, this has been part of IDS from the very beginning. And Dudley Sears, the Institute's first director, wrote a great deal about development in Europe. One of the earliest issues of the IDS Bulletin contained an article by Richard Jolly and a colleague called Britain, A Case for Development. And so it's always been there. And there have been many programs over the decades in the Institute, which have looked at development in the UK and in other countries in Europe and in North America. But I think more significantly have built bridges and mutual learning between countries. And this is what I think is important. So if we were simply to say development studies is something that happens in the UK and Europe, then there's no differentiator really from any other think tank or take the UK as an example, UK-based think tank or university department working on issues at home. I think what development studies does is, again, coming back to this question of power, acknowledges those structural inequalities between different places. It's interested in everywhere, but it's also really interested in the structural inequalities which occur between countries or between groups within them. It pursues issues like poverty, inequality, marginalization, health, pandemic response, environment in all places, but it does so in a way that's often comparative. So yes, there's marginalization in the UK, there's marginalization in Zambia or in India, but what can we learn more about looking at the different ways in which that marginalization's unfolded and how that reflects national and globally positioned processes? And then I think it enables us to move towards a position which is about mutual learning and about reverse learning. So if some versions of development have been envisaged in terms of taking expertise from the so-called global north, from so-called developed countries to so-called developing countries, transferring technology, transferring know-how, transferring resources, I think that now looks rather colonial. And I think if we don't acknowledge that similar problems are also at play in our own backyard and seek to learn in the reverse direction by transferring know-how and lessons and perspectives from parts of the global south to the UK and other countries, then we can't escape this kind of colonial bind. So that would be my response. I mean, in my own research at IDS, I've done this a lot. So our work in the STEPS Centre had many, many case studies and examples that were working on energy in the UK, work on environment and climate in Europe, comparative work. When we turned the STEP Centre into a global consortium, we worked with partners in North America and Arizona State University, within Europe through the Stockholm Resilience Centre, as well as in the UK. And some of our most interesting collaborations involved pairing people up. So you can go, okay, what's happening around home solar systems in East Africa and in the UK, and what can we learn by looking across them, and so on. Likewise, the work I've done on global health around vaccines looked at parents' anxieties about child health and vaccination very close to our IDS own backyard in Brighton in the early 90s, and also in Guinea and the Gambia. And we tried to build cross-learning between those places. More recently, we've had at IDS colleagues from Brazil and partners coming to advise the National Health Service in the UK about how to do good patient involvement and citizen panels, which Brazil has become very, very good at in the context of its indigenous health system. And the NHS has a great deal to learn. Likewise, we've had work on participation, which has often been a set of debates and methods which have been far ahead in many parts of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and much learning now that's come into work with marginalised communities in various bits of the UK, in Bristol, in Gateshead and more. I could go on. I think this is the reality of development and development studies, and certainly needs to be a key part of the future in my view.
Actually, it brings us to a point I wanted to pick up with you was, How should we think about decolonizing knowledge? And are you implicitly and in some ways directly, you said, you know, some of these questions really are about getting away from what was a colonial mindset, even in the 60s and 70s, when you know, and 80s when IDS was kind of in its earlier days and it was now. I mean, when you think about the kind of decolonizing knowledge, how is that debate evolved at IDS in your time, and where do you think? I mean, EARDI, European Association of Development Research and Training Institutes is, you know, has an initiative in this, and it's already got a lot of interest. And so we're here, actually Peter Taylor is convening, as you may know. So we're interested to get more ideas and hear. I mean,
yeah.
How do you see this? How do you see this has evolved, and where do you think it should go now?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a vital set of conversations, and they're ones that at IDS are an integral part of what we've been doing with partners to recast development. That's the term we're using, a kind of recasting and throwing forward into the future. And we've been in discussion with many partners around the world, including with those in the ARD network, and we really welcome this. On decolonizing specifically, I think there are a few things to say. Firstly, this is a term that's become very fashionable of late. But the idea of decentering knowledge and power and bringing into the heart of central thinking practice in development has been around for many, many decades. And I mean, it was, if I look back to, I mean, the work in West Africa that I started talking about, that in some ways had some slightly colonial elements to it. If I now review the film we made, for instance, Second Nature, it has this slightly othering sense that here we had these white foreign anthropologists going to sit down in a village and learn about their lives. And that feels now a little uncomfortable. But at the same time, what that work was also doing was trying to broker other ways of thinking and being, make those not seem other but normal, and to engage in critique of those centralized, as it were, colonial, and there was a direct colonial legacy, set of knowledges in science and in policy, and to critique those. So in that sense, it was also part of now what we would call decolonizing. So, I mean, on decolonizing specifically, it's been around a long time. These are conversations that are multi-stranded and need to be recognized as such. And different countries, regions have are taking forward these conversations in different ways, and so they should. I think a debate about decolonizing cannot be led from those who have the legacy as once the colonizers. So that's a straightforward thing to say. At the same time, I think sometimes talking about decolonization, especially when it comes from ex-colonial people and powers, can come in its own way to seem quite colonial. So some of the reactions I've had from for instance, partners in African settings has been, we don't want to talk about decolonizing. We dealt with that a long time ago. They're seeing decolonizing as something that was part of a movement, a post-independence movement. They say, what matters to us now is equity in our partnerships and in our knowledge sharing. So let's talk about that. And that now seems sometimes a more respectful way to engage in the agendas. At the same time, I don't think we can do away with the critical look at still the ongoing legacies and hierarchies and forms of power, which do have some continuity with the colonial period and the post-colonial period. And I've been, one of the things that I've been able to do and have really enjoyed doing at IDS is to work with our colleagues in the British Library for Development Studies, which is now the collection of documents which emerged from many IDS researchers and partners over the decades. Their materials they collected on their travels, they sat in our basement, and in partnership with the University of Sussex Library, we've had a big grant from the Wellcome Trust to catalogue and bring to light these documents. And they tell some really powerful stories, both of particular themes in development, but also about shifts in mindsets. And are an incredibly important resource, I think, for history and for looking at the histories of development and of development studies, and using that as a basis for questioning and for challenging. And this is something that I think needs to continue into the future. If we look ahead, whether we're framing it in terms of decolonizing or equitable partnerships or reshaping power and knowledge, I think a key part of this is to recognize the plural sources of knowledge, of views about what good change is, to bring into development what is sometimes seen as post-development. So if you look at the scholarship on the pluriverse or the work that's emerging from the networks and the pluriverse movements, Ashish Kothari and many others, and from indeed indigenous philosophies, some of this is talked about as post-development. I think it's part of development and bringing on board those theorizations, those different ways of understanding human non-human relations, those ways of thinking and being that are more relational. These need to be part of our lexicon and the ways that development thinking moves forward into the future. And I hope Ayadi can take them on board in their own conversations.
Thank you. I think that might be a good point to sort of draw the conversation together. It's been really fantastic to have this conversation and to get a chance to ask you these questions. I guess just in terms of wrapping up at the end, just on a kind of lighter note, looking back, is there anything you wish you'd done differently? Or is there anything, if you could press rewind, is there something you'd change, or would you do it all the same again?
I think the way I'd respond to that is that I think what I've learned at IDS is that blueprint plans that you then follow and you say, we're going to do it this way, are never going to work. Our last strategy, I've sort of co-led with people two big strategies at IDS. The first one soon after I arrived, which we called Engaged Excellence. And it was really all about trying to center these notions that we needed to be great, not just at the academic and at the knowledge, but actually at mobilizing that knowledge with partners to make a difference. I suppose one reflection is engaged excellence was a bit of a buzzword. It was one that was lampooned in the IDS pantomime for several years, and probably I'd have been less buzzwordy. But I think the point stands that was a kind of collective process of strategy building, but it wasn't a blueprint. It was a set of things to think about, which then people and groups and partners adapted and made their own over the period. So I think I learned something about flexibility and about adaptation, which then our next strategy took even more to its heart. So 2020 to 2025, which we call transforming knowledge, transforming lives, the strapline was responding to the shocks and disruptions of our era. And my goodness, that came true, because before we launched it, we had the COVID pandemic and then the ensuing economic and political disruptions linked to the climate emergency and linked to others, as well as a whole range of disruptions closer to home in what happened to the Institute's financing amidst aid cuts and what happened to collegial relations amidst some of the problems in the university sector to do with funding and pensions and so on, created a perfect storm of disruptions and shocks, external and internal, which required responding to. So I've learned that flexibility and agility is really important, and that deciding to do things a certain way and sticking to them often isn't the best way to go. We need to be able to adapt. I hope I've been able to do that in a way that's been inclusive, that's listened to a lot of different views and voices, and that's tried to strike a balance between collecting those different perspectives and being able to create some kind of consensus for the moment about how we might move forward together and respond to these shocks in ways that are building a future we can all all live with, bearing in mind that that future's going to change further.
Sounds like very good advice for taking flexibility and resilience in what is increasingly a shock-driven world. Melissa, thank you very much for this. I've really enjoyed speaking and wish you all the best in the future. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and share to help us spread the word.
Do you have a feature that you'd like to appear in a future episode?
Then get in touch on email at betweenthelines@ids.ac.uk.